Chapter 7 Prelude to Crime. Harlan stepped into the kettle at the 2456th and looked backward to make certain that the barrier that separated the shaft from eternity was truly flawless, that sociologist Voy was not watching. In these last weeks, it had grown to be a habit with him, an automatic twitch. There was always the quick backward glance across the shoulder to make sure no one was behind him in the kettle shafts. And then, though already in the 2456th, it was for up when that Harlan set the kettle controls. He watched the numbers on the temperometer rise. Though they moved with blurry quickness, there would be considerable time for thought. How the life plotter's finding changed matters. How the very nature of his crime had changed. And it had all hinged on Finge. The phrase caught at him with its ridiculous rhyme, and its heavy beat circled dizzyingly inside his skull. It hinged on Finge. It hinged on Finge. Harlan had avoided any personal contact with Finge on his return to eternity after those days with Noyes in the 482nd. As eternity closed in about him, so did guilt. A broken oath of office, which seemed nothing in the 482nd, was enormous in eternity. He had sent in his report by impersonal airchute and took himself off to personal quarters. He needed to think this out, gain time to consider, and grow accustomed to the new orientation within himself. Finge did not permit it. He was in communication with Harlan less than an hour after the report had been coded for proper direction and inserted into the chute. The computer's image stared out of the vision plate. His voice said, "I expected you to be in your office." Harlan said, "I delivered the report, sir. It doesn't matter where I wait for a new assignment." "Yes?" Finge scanned the roll of foil he held in his hands, holding it up, squint-eyed, and peering at its perforation pattern. "It is scarcely complete," he went on. "May I visit your rooms?" Harlan hesitated a moment. The man was his superior, and to refuse the self-invitation at this moment would have a flavor of insubordination. It would advertise his guilt, it seemed, and his raw, painful conscience dared not permit that. "You will be welcome, computer," he said stiffly. Finge's sleek softness introduced a jarring element of Epicureanism into Harlan's angular quarters. The 95th, Harlan's home when, tended toward the Spartan in house furnishings, and Harlan had never completely lost his taste for the style. The tubular metal chairs had been surfaced with a dull veneer that had been artificially grained into the appearance of wood, though not very successfully. In one corner of the room was a small piece of furniture that represented an even wider departure from the customs of the times. It caught Finge's eye almost at once. The computer put a pudgy finger on it, as though to test its texture.
"What is this material?"
"Wood, sir," said Harlan.
"The real thing? Actual wood? Amazing. You use wood in your home when, I believe?"
"We do."
"I see. There's nothing in the rules against this, technician."
He dusted the finger with which he had touched the object against the side seam of his trouser leg.
"But I don't know that it's advisable to allow the culture of the home when to affect one. The true eternal adopts whatever culture he is surrounded by. I doubt, for instance, if I have eaten out of an energic utensil more than twice in 5 years."
He sighed.
"And yet to allow food to touch matter has always seemed unclean. But I don't give in. I don't give in."
His eyes returned to the wooden object, but now he held both hands behind his back and said,
"What is it? What is its purpose?"
"It's a bookcase," said Harlan. He had the impulse to ask Finge how he felt now that his hands rested firmly upon the small of his back. Would he not consider it cleaner to have his clothes and his own body constructed of pure and undefiled energy fields? Finge's eyebrows lifted.
"A bookcase. Then those objects resting upon the shelves are books, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Authentic specimens?
Entirely, computer. I picked them up in the 24th. The few I have here date from the 20th. If you intend to look at them, I wish you'd be careful. The pages have been restored and impregnated, but they're not foil. They take careful handling.
I won't touch them. I have no intention of touching them. Original 20th century dust is on them, I imagine. Actual books.
He laughed. Pages of cellulose, too? You implied that.
Harlan nodded. Cellulose modified by the impregnation treatment for longer life, yes. He opened his mouth for a deep breath, forcing himself to remain calm. It was ridiculous to identify himself with these books, to feel a slur upon them, to be a slur upon himself.
I dare say, said Finge, still on the subject, that the whole content of those books could be placed on 2 meters of film and stored in a finger's end. What do the books contain?
Harlan said, they are bound volumes of a news magazine of the 20th.
You read that?
Harlan said proudly, these are a few volumes of the complete collection I have. No library in eternity can duplicate it.
Yes, your hobby. I remember now you once told me about your interest in the primitive.
I'm amazed your educator ever allowed you to grow interested in such a thing. A complete waste of energy.
Harlan's lips thinned. The man, he decided, was deliberately trying to irritate him out of possession of calm reasoning faculties. If so, he must not be allowed to succeed.
Harlan said flatly, I think you've come to see me about my report.
Yes, I have.
The computer looked about, selected a chair, and sat down gingerly.
It is not complete, as I said over the communicator.
In what way, sir?
Calm, calm.
Finge broke into a nervous twitch of a smile.
What happened that you didn't mention, Harlan?
Nothing, sir.
And though he said it firmly, he stood there, hangdog.
Come, technician. You spent several periods of time in the society of the young lady. Or you did if you followed the spatio-temporal chart. You did follow it, I suppose.
Harlan's guilt riddled him to the point where he could not even rise to the bait of this open assault upon his professional competence. He could only say, I followed it.
And what happened? You include nothing of the private interludes with the woman?
Nothing of importance happened, said Harlan, dry-lipped.
That is ridiculous. At your time of life and with your experience, I don't have to tell you that it is not for an observer to judge what is important and what is not.
Finch's eyes were keenly upon Harlan. They were harder and more eager than quite befitted his soft line of questioning. Harlan noted that well, and was not fooled by Finch's gentle voice, yet the habit of duty tugged at him. An observer must report everything. An observer was merely a sense-perceptive pseudopod, thrust out by eternity into time. It tested its surroundings and was drawn back. In the fulfillment of his function, an observer had no individuality of his own. He was not really a man. Almost automatically, Harlan began his narration of the events he had left out of his report. He did it with the trained memory of the observer, reciting the conversations with word-for-word accuracy, reconstructing the tone of voice and cast of countenance. He did it lovingly, for in the telling he lived it again, and almost forgot, in the process, that a combination of Finch's probing and his own healing sense of duty was driving him into an admission of guilt. It was only as he approached the end result of that first long conversation that he faltered and the shell of his observer's objectivity showed cracks. He was saved from further details by the hand that Finge suddenly raised and by the computer's sharp, edgy voice.
Thank you, it is enough. You were about to say that you made love to the woman.
Harlan grew angry. What Finge said was the literal truth. But Finge's tone of voice made it sound lewd, coarse, and worse than that, commonplace. Whatever else it was, or might be, it was not commonplace. Harlan had an explanation for Finge's attitude, for his anxious cross-examination,
for his breaking off the verbal report at the moment he did. Finch was jealous. That much Harlan would have sworn was obvious. Harlan had succeeded in taking away a girl that Finch had meant to have. Harlan felt the triumph in that and found it sweet. For the first time in his life, he knew an aim that meant more to him than the frigid fulfillment of eternity. He was going to keep Finch jealous because Noyes Lambent was to be permanently his. In this mood of sudden exaltation, he plunged into the request that originally he had planned to present only after a wait of a discreet 4 or 5 days. He said, "It is my intention to apply for permission to form a liaison with a timed individual." Finch seemed to snap out of a reverie. "With Noyes Lambent, I presume?"
"Yes, sir. As computer in charge of the section, it will have to go through you."
Harlan wanted it to go through Finch, make him suffer. If he wanted the girl himself, let him say so, and Harlan could insist on allowing Noyes to make her choice. He almost smiled at that. He hoped it would come to that. It would be the final triumph. Ordinarily, of course, a technician could not hope to push through such a matter in the face of a computer's desires, but Harlan was sure he could count on Twistle's backing, and Finch had a long way to go before he could buck Twistle. Finch, however, seemed tranquil.
"It would seem," he said, "that you have already taken illegal possession of the girl."
Harlan flushed and was moved to a feeble defense. "The spatiotemporal chart insisted on our remaining alone together. Since nothing of what happened was specifically forbidden, I feel no guilt." Which was a lie, and from Finch's half-amused expression, one could feel that he knew it to be a lie. He said,
"There will be a reality change."
Harlan said, "If so, I will amend my application to request liaison with Miss Lambent in the new reality."
"I don't think that would be wise.
How can you be sure in advance? In the new reality, she may be married. She may be deformed. In fact, I can tell you this. In the new reality, she will not want you. She will not want you." Harlan quivered.
"You know nothing about it."
"Oh? You think this great love of yours is a matter of soul-to-soul contact? That it will survive all external changes? Have you been reading novels out of time?"
Harlan was goaded into indiscretion. "For one thing, I don't believe you." Finch said coldly,
"I beg pardon."
"You're lying."
Harlan didn't care what he said now.
"You're jealous. It's all it amounts to, you're jealous. You had your own plans for Noyes, but she chose me."
Finch said,
"Do you realize?"
"I realize a great deal. I'm no fool. I may not be a computer, but neither am I an ignoramus. You say she won't want me in the new reality. How do you know? You don't even know yet what the new reality will be. You don't know if there must be a new reality at all. You just received my report. It must be analyzed before a reality change can be computed, let alone submitted for approval. So when you affect to know the nature of the change, you are lying."
There were a number of ways in which Finch might have made response. Harlan's heated mind was aware of many. He did not try to choose among them. Finch might stalk out in affected dudgeon. He might call in a member of security and have Harlan taken into custody for insubordination. He might shout back, yelling as angrily as Harlan. He might put in an immediate call to Twistle, lodging a formal complaint. He might. Finch did none of this. He said gently,
"Sit down, Harlan. Let's talk about this."
And because that response was completely unexpected, Harlan's jaw sagged, and he sat down in confusion. His resolution faltered. What was this?
"You remember, of course," said Finch, "that I told you that our problem with the 482nd involved an undesirable attitude on the part of the timers of the current reality toward eternity. You do remember that, don't you?"
He spoke with the mild urging of a schoolmaster toward a somewhat backward student, yet Harlan thought he could detect a kind of hard glitter
in his eye.
Harlan said, "Of course."
"You remember, too, that I told you that the All-When Council was reluctant to accept my analysis of the situation without specific confirming observations. Doesn't that imply to you that I had already computed the necessary reality change?"
"But my own observations represent the confirmation, don't they?"
"They do.
And it would take time to analyze them properly."
"Nonsense. Your report means nothing. The confirmation lay in what you told me orally moments ago."
"I don't understand you."
"Look, Harlan, let me tell you what is wrong with the 482nd. Among the upper classes of this century, particularly among the women, there has grown up the notion that Eternals are really eternal, literally so, that they live forever."
"Great time, man.
Noyes Lambent told you as much. You repeated her statements to me not 20 minutes ago."
Harlan stared blankly at Finge. He was remembering Noyes's soft, caressing voice as she leaned toward him and caught at his eyes with her own lovely dark glance.
"You live forever. You're an eternal."
Finge went on.
"Now, a belief like that is bad, but in itself not too bad. It can lead to inconveniences, increased difficulties for the section, but computation would show that only in a minority of cases would change be necessary. Still, if a change is desirable, isn't it obvious to you that the inhabitants of the century who must, above all, change maximally with the change, be those who are subject to the superstition? In other words, the female aristocracy. Noyes."
"It may be, but I'll take my chance," said Harlan.
"You have no chance at all. Do you think your fascinations and charm persuaded the soft aristocrat to fall into the arms of an unimportant technician? Come, Harlan, be realistic about this."
Harlan's lips grew stubborn. He said nothing.
Finge said, "Can't you guess the additional superstition which these people have added to their belief in the actual eternal life of the Eternals? Great time, Harlan. Most of the women believe that intimacy with an Eternal will enable a mortal woman, as they think of themselves, to live forever."
Harlan swayed. He could hear Noyes's voice again so clearly.
"If I were made an Eternal, and then her kisses."
Finge went on.
"The existence of such a superstition was hard to believe, Harlan. It was unprecedented. It lay within the region of random error so that a search through the computations for the previous change yielded no information respecting it one way or the other. The All-When Council wanted firm evidence, direct substantiation. I chose Miss Lambent as a good example of her class. I chose you as the other subject."
Harlan struggled to his feet. "You chose me as a subject?"
"I'm sorry," said Finge stiffly, "but it was necessary. You made a very good subject."
Harlan stared at him. Finge had the grace to squirm a bit under that wordless stare. He said,
"Don't you see? No, you still don't. Look, Harlan, you're a cold fish product of eternity. You won't look at a woman. You consider women and all that concerns them unethical. No, there's a better word. You consider them sinful. That attitude shows all over you, and to any woman you'd have all the sex appeal of a month-dead mackerel. Yet here we have a woman, the beautiful, pampered product of a hedonistic culture, who ardently seduces you on your first evening together, virtually begging for your embrace. Don't you understand that that is ridiculous? Impossible, unless, well, unless it is the confirmation we were looking for."
Harlan struggled for words.
"You say she sold herself."
"Why that expression? There is no shame attached to sex in this century. The only strange thing is that she chose you as partner, and that she did for the sake of eternal life. It's plain."
And Harlan, arms raised, hands claw bent, with no rational thought in his mind or any irrational one other than to choke and throttle Finge,
sprang forward. Finge stepped back hastily. He brought out a blaster with a quick, trembling gesture.
Don't touch me. Back!
Harlan had just enough sanity to halt his rush. His hair was matted. His shirt was stained with perspiration. His breath whistled through pinched white nostrils. Finge said shakily,
I know you very well, you see, and I thought your reaction might be violent. Now, I'll shoot if I have to.
Harlan said, Get out.
I will, but first you'll listen. For attacking a computer, you can be declassified, but we'll let that go.
You will understand, however, that I did not lie. The Noyes Lambent of the new reality, whatever else may be or not be, will lack this superstition.
The whole purpose of the change will be to wipe out the superstition, and without it, Harlan.
His voice was almost a snarl.
How could a woman like Noyes want a man like you?
The pudgy computer backed toward the door of Harlan's personal quarters, blaster still leveled. He paused to say with a sort of grim gaiety,
Of course, if you had her now, Harlan, if you had her now, you could enjoy her. You could keep your liaison and make it formal. That is, if you had her now. But the change will come soon, Harlan, and after that you will not have her. What a pity.
The now does not last, even in eternity, eh, Harlan? Harlan no longer looked at him. Finge had won after all and was leaving in clear and leering possession of the field. Harlan stared unseeingly at his own toes, and when he looked up, Finge was gone. Whether 5 seconds earlier or 15 minutes, Harlan could not have said. Hours had passed, nightmarishly, and Harlan felt trapped in the prison of his mind. All that Finge had said was so true, so transparently true. Harlan's observer mind could look back upon the relationship of himself and Noyes, that short, unusual relationship, and it took on a different texture. It wasn't a case of instant infatuation. How could he have believed it was? Infatuation for a man like himself? Of course not. Tears stung his eyes, and he felt ashamed. How obvious it was that the affair was a case of cool calculation. The girl had certain undeniable physical assets and no ethical principles to keep her from using them. So she used them, and that had nothing to do with Andrew Harlan as a person. He simply represented her distorted view of eternity and what it meant. Automatically, Harlan's long fingers caressed the volumes in his small bookshelf. He took one out and, unseeingly, opened it. The print blurred. The faded colors of the illustrations were ugly, meaningless blotches. Why had Finge troubled to tell him all this? In the strictest sense, he ought not to have. An observer, or anyone acting as observer, ought never to know the ends attained by his observation. It removed him by so much from the ideal position of the objective, non-human tool. It was to crush him, of course, to take a mean and jealous revenge. Harlan fingered the open page of the magazine. He found himself staring at a duplication, in startling red, of a ground vehicle similar to vehicles characteristic of the 45th, 182nd, 590th, and 984th centuries, as well as of late primitive times. It was a very common sort of affair with an internal combustion motor. In the primitive era, natural petroleum fractions were the source of power, and natural rubber cushioned the wheels. That was true of none of the later centuries, of course. Harlan had pointed that out to Cooper. He had made quite a point of it, and now his mind, as though longing to turn away from the unhappy present, drifted back to that moment. Sharp, irrelevant images filled the ache within Harlan. These advertisements, he had said, tell us more of primitive times than the so-called news articles in the same magazine. The news articles assume a basic knowledge of the world it deals with. It uses terms it feels no necessity of explaining. What is a golf ball, for instance? Cooper had professed his ignorance readily. Harlan went on in the didactic tone he could scarcely avoid on occasions such as this. We could deduce that it was a small pellet of some sort from the nature of the casual mentions it receives. We know that it is used in a game, if only because it is mentioned in an item under the heading sport. We can even make further deductions that it is hit by a long rod of some sort, and the object of the game is to drive the ball into a hole in the ground. But why bother with deduction and reasoning? Observe this advertisement. The object of it is only to induce readers to buy the ball. But in so doing, we are presented with an excellent close-range portrait of one, with a section cut into it to show its construction. Cooper, coming from an era in which advertisement was not as wildly proliferative as it was in the later centuries of primitive times, found all this difficult to appreciate. He said, "Isn't it rather disgusting the way these people blow their own horn? Who would be fool enough to believe a person's boastings about his own products? Would he admit defects? Is he likely to stop at any exaggeration?" Harlan, whose home when was middling fruitful in advertisement, raised tolerant eyebrows, and merely said, "You'll have to accept that. It's their way, and we never quarrel with the ways of any culture as long as it does not seriously harm mankind as a whole." But now, Harlan's mind snapped back to his present situation, and he was back in the present, staring at the loud-mouthed, brassy advertisements in the news magazine. He asked himself in sudden excitement, were the thoughts he had just experienced really irrelevant, or was he torturously finding a way out of the blackness and back to Noyes? Advertisement. A device for forcing the unwilling into line. Did it matter to a ground vehicle manufacturer whether a given individual felt an original or spontaneous desire for his product? If the prospect, that was the word, could be artificially persuaded or cajoled into feeling that desire and acting upon it, would that not be just as well? Then what did it matter if Noyes loved him out of passion or out of calculation? Let them but be together long enough and she would grow to love him. He would make her love him, and in the end, love, and not its motivation, was what counted. He wished now he had read some of the novels out of time that Finch had mentioned scornfully. Harlan's fists clenched at a sudden thought. If Noyes had come to him, to Harlan, for immortality, it could only mean that she had not yet fulfilled the requirement for that gift. She could have made love to no eternal previously. That meant that her relationship to Finch had been nothing more than that of secretary and employer. Otherwise, what need would she have had for Harlan? Yet Finch surely must have tried, must have attempted. Harlan could not complete the thought even in the secrecy of his own mind. Finch could have proved the superstition's existence on his own person. Surely he could not have missed the thought with Noyes and ever-present temptation. Then she must have refused him. He had had to use Harlan, and Harlan had succeeded. It was for that reason that Finch had been driven into the jealous revenge of torturing Harlan with the knowledge that Noyes's motivation had been a practical one, and that he could never have her. Yet Noyes had refused Finch even with eternal life at stake, and had accepted Harlan. She had that much of a choice, and she had made it in Harlan's favor. So it wasn't calculation entirely. Emotion played a part. Harlan's thoughts were wild and jumbled and grew more heated with every moment. He must have her, and now. Before any reality change. What was it Finch had said to him, jeering? "The now does not last, even in eternity." Doesn't it, though? Doesn't it? Harlan had known exactly what he must do. Finch's angry taunting had goaded him into a frame of mind where he was ready for crime, and Finch's final sneer had, at least, inspired him with the nature of the deed he must commit. He had not wasted a moment after that. It was with excitement and even joy that he left his quarters, at all but a run, to commit a major crime against eternity.